Genesis 27. That this text that we're about to read, last week we started with Jacob and Esau in the taking of the birthright by bargaining over a bowl of stew or a bowl of lentils, red lentils. That these, have you any ever heard of red lentils? They're delicious, by the way. But this bargaining over these red lentils, the birthright. This narrative that we're about to be in Genesis 27 is Jacob deceiving his father with the help of his mother to take the blessing away from Esau and bring it to Jacob. And so we're going to be there. Now, something we need to grab hold of before I read this text that I want to set us up here. Many of you know this narrative already. You've heard it before. You've been taught this since you were a kid in Sunday school, and that's fantastic. But there's a piece that I want to share with you. That in order to really grab hold of the text, we need to understand that this text, that the ancient Near East people was a society of oral communication. That's not what we are. We are a society of written communication predominantly. There has been a shift towards the visual that has occurred with things like YouTube, for example. Even the way that people communicate with GIFs today is something that is moving towards this idea that the visual is meant to communicate something, but that we still predominantly are a written culture. And so that's the reason why even when you go on the internet, for example, and you're on a website, that you're reading a blog. You're reading these types of things. You have a Bible either on your phone or a tablet, or you have a written copy of the Bible that you read. And this is very, very different than what the ancient Near East was. The ancient Near East was an oral culture in that the spoken word actually had a much heavier emphasis than what we have today. So much so that people really didn't worry about writing because a lot of people were just simply illiterate. But that part of the reality was that, for example, in the times of Jesus, when Jesus was a boy, that the standard 6 or 7 year old Jewish boy would have had Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy memorized. It wasn't good enough just that they had their own copy, which they wouldn't have had. The scrolls of the scripture would have been kept at the synagogue or at the temple. But that the word was more important to be spoken rather than to be written or read. Now, there's also something else with this, is that because of this, when people spoke something, it had incredibly more weight in their day than it does in ours. So for example, if you were going to contract a business deal in our world, that business deal isn't formally really have happened until both parties have signed on the dotted line, right? Because there's all of this written stuff in a contract. Again, we are a written culture. All of these written things in the contract, and that everyone signs and says, yes, this is what we're doing. In the ancient Near East, rather than things getting done by writing and signing, that things were done by speaking. And so when you spoke something, something very real happened. It was not just this, like, because you guys know some of the narrative, we're about to read it. It's not just this nice, fancy thing that someone, oh, I want to be nice to you today, so I'm going to bless you. When you bless someone, that something concrete, almost tangible, occurred in that person's life. At least that was the expectation. And that part of our movement away from ancient cultures and ancient thoughts of the world to a more modern mindset is that words don't have that type of power. Part of what we're going to be discussing today is, no, words do have that kind of power. And maybe our words don't have the ability to create something out of nothing the way that God does, but that our worlds do construct other worlds. Our words do shape and mold and affect other people. And that we need to recognize that that's a reality. So I want us to set up this whole thing because of this text that we're about to read in Genesis 27 around the idea of making sure that we understand that when Isaac speaks the words of blessing, this is a big deal. This isn't just like, oh, well, why didn't he just like write it into his will? No, this is huge. This is a very, very important thing. So Genesis 27, this is a little bit of a lengthy passage. So I encourage you, even if you want to follow along in your text, I encourage you to use your imagination to kind of put yourself there so that way you can allow the narrative to speak to you. So here we go. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt for game for me, and prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food, that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me two good young goats, so that I may prepare from them delicious food for your father, such as he loves, and you shall bring it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go, bring them to me." So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son, and the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she put the delicious food in the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "You are really my son Esau? Are you really my son Esau?" He said, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed." I don't know about you, but that's not how I want to be described if I was someone's going to say what I smelled like, but to each their own. "May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game that you may bless me." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" He answered, "I am your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came and have blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed." As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." Then he said, "Have you not reserved the blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and your brothers, and you shall serve your brother. And when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." This is the word of the Lord, the nurture and admonition of his people today. I think that there's only one set of words, that, at least that I can think of off the top of my head, that have the type of impact that Isaac and Esau and Jacob and Rebekah experienced with the way the ancient Near East people thought. It happens when people come up to an altar like this one here, and they're surrounded by friends and family, and a groom and a bride say to each other, "I do." And that suddenly there's something changes in the midst of them, that they're no longer just a bride and a groom, but they are now a husband and a wife, that there's something different now about that relationship, and that there's this type of understanding in this. It's interesting as we take a look at this text that these folks are so concerned about the words of Isaac. The words of Isaac are the most important piece of this particular set of texts. Is that everyone's worried about what Isaac is going to say. What is Isaac going to say, and who is he going to say it to? And in the whole time, Rebekah's concerned about what Isaac is going to say. Jacob's concerned about what Isaac's going to say, and who is he going to say it to? Esau's concerned about what Isaac's going to say. And the whole time, all three of them are completely not paying attention to what they say and who they say it to. Maybe not recognizing, as we said earlier, that our words really are important. What we say, how we say it, and who we say it to are critically important to us. This is a reality of this text that we take a look at, and I want to take a look at each of these kind of characters individually and discuss them briefly about how their words changed the world in which they lived and what it communicated about one another. And so we have Isaac calling his son Esau, as we read just a few moments ago, and that he says, "I'm going to bless you. Go. I want to go eat of your game first, and I'm going to bless you." And that this really interesting thing happens. Rebekah was listening. And she kind of overheard a conversation. Have you ever had one of those moments at a restaurant when, like, the people across the aisle from you are just talking entirely too loud? You know what I'm talking about? And, like, you're getting details about that marriage or about those people that you really don't need to know. Or even better, you know, it happens, it's not just there, but that, oh, there's somebody in the hallway. Oh, that's an interesting tidbit. I wonder who, you know, so-and-so really needs to know this. That's exactly what Rebecca does, is that presumably she's in the tent, the house, whatever it might be with Isaac, and she overhears this conversation. She goes, "Jacob really needs to know about this." And so she then works it, and she brings Jacob to her and says, "Hey, I got a plan. And we talked a little bit about plans last week and how we need to be making sure that our plans are placed before the feet of God, and that we need to recognize that our plans are not necessarily God's plans, and that our thoughts aren't necessarily God's thoughts. Praise the Lord for that, because if my thoughts were God's thoughts, that would be a very, very bad thing. But that Rebekah takes her plan and says, "Jacob, you need to hear this thing that your dad told me. Your dad told, oh, he didn't tell me. Actually, he told your brother. You need to hear what he told your brother." And Rebekah goes, we're going to work this thing out to make sure that you get the blessing. Jacob's interesting in the midst of this because he hears Rebekah's plan and goes, "This isn't going to work, Mom. Like, Dad's going to figure this out. He's not dumb. He knows the difference between Esau and I, and he's going to touch me, and suddenly I'm going to have a curse thrown on me instead of a blessing." Now, you got to remember, you might get cursed on the highway or blessed by someone, and that's not the, you know, that can just roll off your shoulders. When someone curses someone in their world, that this is a real deal, like something serious happened when someone curses you. And so that Jacob starts using his words, and instead of just saying, "Mom, I don't know if this is, it's just not, I don't know if this is a good idea," but saying, "Mom, I can't do that. Then he goes, let's try to figure this thing out a little bit. Might be a part of what Jacob's going on with. Let's figure out a way to do it so that oh, let your curse be upon me, son. Okay. And suddenly Jacob's willing to use his words to start to manipulate and deceive as well. And then we come finally to Jacob with it before his father in verses 18 through 30. And then he has this whole situation where he's flatly lying to him. Who is it? Oh, it's Esau, your firstborn. Right. Or, are you really my son Esau? Yep. Really? But again, that his words, he's not, all he's worried about is what's Isaac going to say? He's not even concerned or thinking about what are my words doing? What is the world that my words are creating? All I'm concerned about is the world that Isaac's words are creating, and I'm not even thinking at all about the world that my words are creating. And that he ends up having this situation where he lies to him. You have to know, come on, Jacob had to have been aware that stealing his brother's blessing in such a deceitful manner was going to upset him. I mean, honestly, it's the whole, think about inheritances, right? That you have an estate that's unsettled and that various folks of the family are arguing over the estate. Could you imagine if someone just kind of swindled the whole thing? And that brother and sister would not be upset? Sure they would. You had to know that Jacob was going to make his brother very angry, if not incredibly broken. But that he does it anyway. He's not anticipating. He doesn't really allow the effects of his words to settle on what in the world is going to happen if I follow through on this plan. And so Jacob proceeds with the deceit. And that we have this incredible interchange between Isaac and Esau that we read. And then finally Esau saying to himself, again, words, my father's going to die. It's what the days of mourning for my father are approaching. But then I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him. Do we see that these words, think about Rebekah for a moment, think about Jacob, that they're using their words to maneuver this thing to Jacob's side and have completely neglected to think about what in the world is Esau going to think and do? This is the mother of this boy. He's probably a man by this point, but that this is his mom. And that she is putting things in action. Rebekah is putting things in action with the help of her other son that is going to break this boy. That the text, I don't know if we understand the depth of the pathos of this, that he cries out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry. The image that comes to mind to me is someone who tragically loses a loved one. And that what in just a complete breakdown, a complete snapping in half of that person's mental makeup and emotional makeup for that period of time. And that this was meditated by his mom. Now, as we started last week, when we take a look at this family, this family's dysfunctional, right? Now, if there's anything that should be of hope to us, is that the blessing and promise of God rested on a family with incredible dysfunction. And if anything, that should give a lot of hope for me. Because I have plenty of dysfunction in mine. In that the blessing and promise of God can still come to me in the midst of junk. I believe firmly that the wisdom writers in particular, the book of Proverbs and the book of James, James is really a wisdom book in the New Testament. And is even referenced by people as the New Testament book of wisdom. And in your discussion groups this week, you're going to be taking a look at the book of James. But that I believe that the wisdom writers, the writers of the Proverbs and James, understood fully the weight of words. That they understood that when we speak, it's not just like this fluffy thing that happens, but that when we speak, worlds are being created, if you will. Relationships are being built or they're being broken. good things are being set up or bad things are being set up. And that it's the reason why, for example, that the proverb writers say such things as a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh answer basically eggs it on. And it's also the reason why the writer of the Proverbs say that where there are many words, sin is not absent. Let that settle in, particularly for someone like me who likes to talk. That there are other things, for example, in the Proverbs where it says, it is a fool who pulls a joke on his neighbor and then goes to a neighbor and says, it was just a joke. Our practical jokesters. That's exactly what we do. We pull pranks and then go, kidding. That these are all wrapped up. I would encourage you to read through the Proverbs to understand that the Proverbs very much understand that the mouth is a gate. And that so much of who we are flows through this mouth. It's the reason why Jesus later says in the Gospel of Mark, it's not what goes in that defiles you, but rather it is what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. Because it is what you speak that describes what's going on in here. And I think that's what's really so core and critical to this text, is that when we take a look and we see Rebekah and Jacob's words, and even Esau's words following the deception that occurs, is that it's not really about the words. It's not even really about the blessing. I want to suggest to you that Esau does receive blessing from God. I find that the answer, the question that Esau places in verse 38, "Have you but one blessing, my father?" And Isaac never answers him, which I believe that the text invites us to start thinking, does God only bless one person? No, he doesn't just bless one. But that the idea is that all of these words, Rebekah's words, Jacob's words, Esau's animosity that comes out in his own self-speak of, I'm going to kill that kid, is not really about those words. It's really about what's going on right here. What's going on internally? What's this turmoil that's going on? I'll give you an example of this, of the way that words can shape worlds in a little bit more more contemporary setting. In fact, it happened in my home earlier this week. How many of you like sauerkraut? Oh, there are more people in this service that like sauerkraut than in the first service, just so you know. I had like three hands first service. Michael, we need to educate you, okay? We will make it happen, okay? Because we have jars of it at my house. It's delicious. But for those of you who don't like sauerkraut, I'm sorry that you're not cultured, but that's okay. I'm joking. But anyway, we had sauerkraut for New Year's. That's a Pennsylvania Dutch tradition that you have sauerkraut at New Year's. And it's meant to be a sauerkraut and pork. It's a good tidings thing for New Year's. And so we had some leftover sauerkraut, and one of my favorite foods in the world are Reuben sandwiches. Reubens are wonderful, and for those of you who don't know what a Reuben is, it's corned beef, a Swiss cheese, Thousand Island dressing, and sauerkraut, and it's grilled on rye bread, and it is wonderful. Yeah, and you can have some mustard on it. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So we had some leftover sauerkraut, and I said to Heather earlier in the week, oh, how are we going to use this up? I said, let's have Reubens. Like, okay, so we went and got the stuff for the Reubens in the middle of the week, and so we started. I got the pan out, I pull out the sauerkraut, and my kids are hungry, and I have Noah come to me, and he sees the sauerkraut, and he goes, Dad, what are you going to make for dinner? And I said, I'm going to make a sandwich. He goes, am I going to like it? And I said, Noah, you've never had this before. I'm not going to like it. Guess what? I go, Noah, you've never had this before. Please don't say that. And of course, his brothers hear him say something like, that sauerkraut's gross. Right? That's what Noah says. And what happens? Asher and Micah goes, that's gross. Noah just created a world with his words. Someone else's world. It wasn't his own. He just created a world for Asher and Micah, who have never eaten a Reuben sandwich before either, and have no idea how blessed they're going to be. And so I had a meeting that I needed to go to that evening. So I had to go get a shower because I stank. I did not. I might have smelled like a field that the Lord blessed. I don't know. But that so I was eating the sauerkraut. So I had to go get a shower. Heather finished the sandwiches and was getting the kids together. And I'm in the bedroom getting dressed, and I hear Noah chattering, and I hear it kind of get quiet in there. And I'm like, I wonder if Heather made them eat these sandwiches. And I'm like, that's good. I hope so. And I'm like, I don't hear any complaining. Now, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I all of a sudden, I hear Noah say, that was pretty good. And I come out and say, hey, Noah, what do you think about that sandwich? I want another one. Come on. So, but this is the reality. I hope that we see that the nature, think about the way of our words, that our complaining and grumbling, Noah's complaining and grumbling in the situation where he had no idea what in the world was going on. I was planning on blessing him with something amazing, but he had no idea what was going on. And all that he knew is, I don't like sauerkraut. Poor kid, and that he didn't, and that he instead, with the use of his words, created a world full of miserableness for 20 to 25 minutes while we're making sandwiches, and his brothers are now complaining, and that it's all just a big mess. And then he finally takes a bite and he goes, that was really good. And that I would dare say that his complaining and grumbling had nothing to do with sauerkraut or Swiss cheese or corned beef or rye bread. It had everything to do with the fact that Noah just really wanted something. He wanted something. He wanted something else. He wanted something sweet, or he wanted pizza, or he wanted Chick-fil-A, or he wanted, I don't know, whatever it might have been. That's what he wanted. And that what was coming out of the fridge wasn't what he wanted. So really what this was about, all of the miserable grumbling and him pulling this and creating this whole new world for Asher and Micah, his younger brothers, really stemmed from what James would say. Why is there fights and quarrels among you? Because you have desires in your heart that are pulling you and tugging you away. It directly connects with Jesus saying, it is what comes out of your mouth that defiles you, because it is exactly a picture of what's going on inside. Do we see? I don't want to be like Noah in that regard. There's lots of things about Noah that I absolutely adore, and I need to emulate in my own life. He has a zeal for things sometimes that I wish I had. But that in this regard, that grumbling and complaining is using our words in a way that is just blah, and is really speaking ill about yourself rather than there's nothing wrong with Reuben sandwiches. Noah's words didn't make Reuben sandwiches gross. All it did was demonstrate to the rest of the house that Noah had a miserable attitude at that moment, and then brought everyone else's attitudes down with him. But there was nothing wrong with that Reuben sandwich. And that when we grumble and complain about things and grumble and complain about people, that oftentimes it has nothing to do with that person. That's a good person, just like that was a good Reuben sandwich. But rather, what we're communicating is about our own heart and our own lives and our own miserableness, and that rather than dealing with the junk that's going on inside, we rather grumble and complain and bring everyone else into our miserableness along with us, because misery loves company. Unfortunately, I'm just as guilty about this as anyone else, that I can allow that to happen to me. I want us to, instead of being like Rebecca and Jacob, or even Esau, who then hides his words, he uses them, he conceals his thoughts by speaking to himself. I'm going to be talking about that in James, the ways that words can be offensive or defensive, the way that words can bring life or bring blessing. And that rather than being any of those three, the one person who seems to use his words right is Isaac. Isaac is the one dude that doesn't say anything that actually hurts somebody. He's the one person in the narrative, and he's the blind guy. He's the guy I don't want you to be blind, but I want you to be like Isaac. And it's unfortunate. Isaac is kind of like an afterthought in Genesis. We get this like big narrative about Abraham and all that Isaac is, and his attachment that almost dies with Abraham. And then we have all of these stories about Jacob and Joseph, his son and grandson. But that Isaac gets very, very little. He almost dies and then he's blind and he gets deceived. But that the reality is that Isaac's words are the words that bring life to people. Even to Esau, when he says that your dwelling will be away from the fatness of the earth and away from the dew of heaven. And that's not nice things. Esau's descendants are the Edomites who lived up in the hills of modern-day Jordan. But that even with all of that not nice stuff going on, that even in the midst of that, there's a word of hope that Isaac speaks, that when you grow restless, you're going to break the yoke of your brother's rule over you. That there's a word of freedom and hope, even in the midst of Isaac having to tell Esau some not nice stuff. I want to be an Isaac that when I look at someone that I use my words to build up rather than to tear down. I want to share this verse from you from Ephesians 4 that means a lot to me, and share kind of a nasty story that goes along with it. But Ephesians 4 says this. Paul's writing to the church at Ephesus, and he says, "Do not let anything unwholesome proceed from your mouth, but only that which is necessary for the building of others up according to their needs. Let nothing unwholesome proceed from your mouth." Now, when I hear the word wholesome, the first thing that I think of usually is milk. And I don't know why. It's just, I don't know if it's some milk advertisement from when I was a child in the late 80s and early 90s, I guess, that milk is this, it does a body good, right? And so I think of milk as this wholesome thing. And so when I read that text and I go, "Let nothing unwholesome proceed from your mouth," I think of something very, very gross that pertains to milk. It was February of my senior year of high school. I had a bowl of Raisin Bran in the morning. It was cold out. There was actually snow on the ground. And I rode the bus to school. It was about a 25-minute drive, half-hour drive from my house to the school. I was going to Sealands Grove Area High School. And as I was riding on the bus over that half hour, I was now pushing 45 minutes to an hour since I'd eaten this bowl of Raisin Bran. And my stomach was getting very, very unsettled. And it was just, I could tell something was not right. You know that feeling, many of you. And I got off the bus loop, and I was coming in the back door of the high school where the buses drop off all the kids, and there's this a row of hedges off the side of the sidewalk. And I promptly, getting off the bus, deposited my Raisin Bran into the bushes at Sealands Grove Area High School. You follow me? Now, something amazing happened is that I deposited the Raisin Bran and the milk that went along with it into those bushes, and suddenly I felt fantastic. Right? I actually didn't have, I wasn't sick. You know what it was? Is there was something very unwholesome about that milk that morning that made me very, very sick. And that when I read that text, when I hear, "Let nothing unwholesome proceed from your mouth," the image that comes into my brain is that February morning, my senior year of high school, 17 years old, me spewing Raisin Bran and spoiled milk into the bushes. And Lord, have mercy upon me if my words are that type of rancid milk upon someone else's life. That is not what my words are meant to do. Let nothing unwholesome proceed from my mouth. That you would need to smell that type of rant. You guys have smelled spoiled milk before, I assume. That is one of the most grotesque smells that I've ever smelled. There's very few that rank up there. Spoiled potatoes and rotten watermelons. Those ones are really bad too. But that spoiled milk proceeding from your mouth is the absolute opposite of what you're supposed to do. Jesus is so concerned about this that he says in Matthew that every word that you speak, you will be held accountable for. That's terrifying. Allow words that build up and nurture and encourage. Words of truth. Jacob was flat out a liar here. Don't be deceitful with your words. You're creating a world for someone that's fake, even when you're trying to be nice. great example. We had a series of people that would sing for offertories at our previous church. We had a set of sisters that would sing, and the one in particular, just she was not a singer. Wonderful girl, fantastic girl, just she was not a singer. And she had been propped up over a course of years. They would sing, "Oh, that was so lovely. Oh, thank you so much." The girl couldn't sing. And there was going to be a day when someone was going to look at her and say, "That really hurt my ears." And she's going to be destroyed because a world had been created for her that was completely and utterly false. It's like the beginning of American Idol, right? With those opening episodes of American Idol, those of you used to watch that show, and the people would come to sing, and they would go, "Oh, wow, that was horrible." But somebody, somewhere in that person's life, looked at that person who just made a fool of themselves on network television, that they had a wonderful singing voice, because they didn't have the guts in the moment to say, "You know what? Maybe that's really not what you should be doing." Speaking truth is critical. But speaking truth does not need to be condemning. But rather, speaking truth can be wholesome and edifying in building others up according to their needs. In Ephesians 4, 29 through 31, I believe it is. So are you going to be an Isaac today? You're going to be an Isaac tomorrow. You look at your spouses. These are married in here. I bet none of you have ever had an argument with your spouse. You want to talk about a place where our words can become unwholesome very, very quickly. If you think about your children, your grandchildren, your parents, you never grumble or complain about them, do you? You never complain about your spouse. Let nothing unwholesome proceed from your mouth, but only that which is necessary for the building others up according to their needs. And if you do that, I have confidence to say that God will transform your relationships. God will transform a relationship with your spouse. God will transform a relationship with your children. God will transform a relationship with your parents if you're willing to speak words that build others up according to their needs in truth. So don't be Rebecca. Don't go around listening saying, "Oh, wow, that sounded really good. Someone needs to know about this." Don't be Jacob, who twists words to his own benefit. Don't be Esau, who when he's hurt, hides his language to himself so that way he can rest in his bitterness and hatred for his brother. Be an Isaac, whose words speak blessing and life and hope into those around you.